glory, bring her but to glorious bow.
We bring you now The Living of These Days, the weekly radio service of the Pilgrim Congregational Church, 2310 East 4th Street in Duluth. Now here's the minister, Dr. Royal F. Shepherd, Jr.
When you read the story of Jesus in the Gospels, you get the picture of a man who spent much of his time in the midst of crowds. All around him are those steaming multitudes, pressing to get closer, wanting to touch his robe. On one occasion, we find Jesus getting into a boat on Lake Galilee and pushing off from shore a little bit so that he can get enough distance between himself and the multitude to be able to speak to them. But Jesus did not only work with crowds. We also see him in small, intimate circles, the home of Mary and Martha, the 12 disciples at the Last Supper. Finally, and this is often overlooked, I think, we find Jesus deliberately going off to be by himself. We discover that he is not only a man of the crowds, but a man of solitude. What is the value of solitude, and why is solitude so hard to come by today? In a few moments, I plan to speak to those questions.
Welcome to The Living of These Days,
the weekly service of Pilgrim Congregational Church. I'm Royal Shepherd, minister of Pilgrim Church, and joining me in bringing you this service are members of our church choir. I'd like to begin my sermon by reading two little snippets from the Gospels. The first one is from Matthew. Then he made the disciples get into the boat and go before him to the other side while he dismissed the crowds. And after he had dismissed the crowds, he went up the mountain by himself to pray. When evening came, he was there alone. And the next little reading is from Mark. And in the morning, a great while before the day, he rose and went to a lonely place, and there he prayed. And Simon and those who were with him pursued him. And they found him and said to him, "Everyone is searching for you." Winter in Duluth becomes for many people a season of desperation. At first it is refreshing, but after a while the length of it begins to wear on people. The length is not measured by simple addition. It is a compounding of inconveniences, of confinements indoors, of chilled joints, of anxieties over travel, of reduced commerce, of gatherings depleted and projects postponed, of the aching hunger for grass, flowers, birds, leaves, life. The Duluth late winter depression is widely acknowledged, even by people who wear booster buttons. Well, I have one antidote for that problem, and that is the suggestion that the community organize each year a great winter festival, not so much to attract the tourists as to distract the natives. I have also, however, another proposal that I'd like to talk about this morning, and this has more to do with the individual. Winter in Duluth brings a summons to solitude. These still white landscapes call us to those clear depths that underlie ourselves. The pure, pristine silence of the standing birches images for us a silence deeper and more primordial, out of which our lives renew. You may have to go outside the city to find this and then pray very hard that no snowmobile charges through the temple courts. But the opportunity is here. Some years ago, I made up a photographic Christmas card looking out from our little cabin at Island Lake, looking out through the birches and toward the water. And I attached to it these words. This stillness and this clarity, this study in suspended time and space, laid out in sleep, this purity is not death, but dormancy. And when you come to it to be, all senses open to the silence and join it, you enter the abyss of peace that is life coiled up for the new birth. When no bird sings, we are challenged to seek the meaning of being alone. So then, in this midwinter, today and next Sunday, I plan to speak of solitude. In doing so, I shall draw freely from others who have spoken tellingly of solitude in our time: Paul Tillich, Anne Lindbergh, Thomas Merton, Henry Nguyen, and more. As I said recently, I think, the church in the 80s should revive the life of prayer. And so now I speak of solitude as one of those basic conditions of prayer. He went to a lonely place, we read of Jesus, and he prayed. Of course, I'm well aware that for many people, people who live alone, solitude often seems more of a curse than a blessing. And that's one of the issues that we need to speak to. But for the present, let me justify my theme by laying down three propositions, which in the light of our contemporary culture may seem to you rather outrageous. Here are the propositions. No one can be himself until he learns to be by himself. No one can be together with another until he learns to be alone. No one can find unity with God until he steps out of the crowd. If these propositions do indeed sound rather outrageous, it is because our modern culture abhors solitude the way nature abhors a vacuum. No doubt the root of this abhorrence lies precisely in the fear that solitude will lead us into a kind of vacuum. André Maurois wrote, "Men fear silence as they fear solitude, because both give them a glimpse of the terror of life's nothingness." That glimpse of nothingness is part of the price we must pay for solitude. Like every good thing, solitude is won only by courage, and we are not very brave. But let's be more specific about how our contemporary society attacks and runs away from solitude. One way is by ceaseless activity. If we can just keep busy, and if we can keep busy in so many different ways that we never have a chance to ponder any one of them, we may hold the terror at bay. Anne Lindberg characterized the lives of modern women by a German word which translated into English means torn to pieces-hood. As a corrective, she recommended that women oppose what she called the centrifugal forces of today by quiet time alone, contemplation, prayer, music, a centering line of thought. But our culture tends to oppose these efforts at solitary centering. It seems to say that it is better for us to be running hard in many directions than to stand still, even for a moment, to look at the map. It tries to counter the terror of nothingness with guilt about idleness. A second way in which our culture opposes solitude is through the worship of togetherness. It is often, of course, a very shallow togetherness. It is life in the crowd, and consequently, life often in isolation and loneliness, for no one is so lonely as when he is in the midst of a crowd. Thomas Merton described this situation very well. He wrote, "When men live huddled together without true communication, there seems to be a greater sharing and a more genuine communion. But this is not communion, only immersion in the general meaninglessness of countless slogans and clichés repeated over and over again, so that in the end one listens without hearing and responds without thinking. The constant din of empty words and machine noises, the endless booming of loudspeakers, end by making true communication and true communion almost impossible. Each individual in the mass is insulated by thick layers of insensibility. He doesn't care, he doesn't hear, he doesn't think. He does not act, he is pushed. He does not talk, he produces conventional sounds when stimulated by the appropriate noises. He does not think, he secretes clichés." Well, that's rather hard, and we might may cross that off as the melancholy prejudice of a monk. What right has a hermit to speak of crowds? Just as we lay on ourselves the guilt of idleness if we spend a few moments in solitary contemplation, so we lay on ourselves the guilt of being antisocial if we withdraw to see if there is anything more to us than what the crowd provides. Most of us exemplify Kierkegaard's saying that it is easier to be a mere numeral within the crowd than to become a true individual before God. We think that unless we are always relating to someone else, it doesn't matter how, we are committing the unforgivable sin. We must relate, even though that means invading another person's privacy. Lately, I have noted how frequently in films and TV dramas, one character who is supposed to be very close to another character will break in on the other's reflections by saying, "What are you thinking?" Now, I suppose in a drama, such questions as that are needed in order to keep the dialogue moving. An audience is impatient with the character who's just sitting there with an empty face. I am impatient. I say to myself, thousands of dollars of production and viewing time are being used up while we all stare at this mindless face looking off at nothing, whereas in the good old days when life was faster paced, this character would have shot down three bad guys, paid off the mortgage, and married the girl, all within this same 20 seconds. But I have wondered, too, how often does this same question get asked in real life in those situations? How often do husband and wife come upon each other alone and, feeling left out, feel forced to ask, "What are you thinking about?" One would think that in most cases, if another person wanted us to know what they were thinking, they would tell us on their own. We forget that intimacy requires respect for the solitude of another. But our culture insists that you and I be together, not understanding that you and I are only fractions of ourselves unless we have a chance to be by ourselves and to think our own thoughts. But these last observations begin to dovetail with a third element in our contemporary culture, which I think tends to get in the way of solitude. And this one I would call the openness cult. It is heartening to find that in the Dutch-American priest, Henry Nguyen, we have someone at last who has found the courage to challenge the creed of this new American religion. He writes, "There is a false form of honesty that suggests that nothing should remain hidden and that everything should be said, expressed, and communicated. This honesty can be very harmful, and if it does not harm, at least it makes the relationship flat, superficial, empty, and often very boring. It is our vocation," he says, "to prevent the harmful exposure of our inner sanctuary, not only for our own protection, but also as a service to our fellow human beings with whom we want to enter into a creative communion. Just as words lose their power when they are not born out of silence, so openness loses its meaning when there is no ability to be closed." These, then, are some of the biases in our culture that lead us to despise and to fear solitude. Of course, in practice, we are more aware of those little down-to-earth obstacles that get in the way. "When can I find solitude?" the mother of a brood of young children asks. "You speak of the winter silence and the standing birches and all that kind of thing. But when I experience silence, I also experience horror and dread, and it's not because I'm afraid of a vacuum. It's due to the certain knowledge that when it grows quiet in my house, something terrible is happening. The baby is chewing the dog's bone, or my husband has spilled grape juice on the carpet. And if I tried to stay alone for 3 minutes from dawn until midnight, all the rest of the family would find togetherness in the ward of a hospital." Well, the truth is, we do face these practical obstacles. They're always there. But I think attitudes have a lot to do with how we get around them and how we help other people get around them. For example, the husband might help his wife to find a little solitude by giving that baby a pacifier and by doing his grape juice drinking in the kitchen. Of course, it is important that we distinguish true solitude from the simple state of being alone. As many have observed, a true solitude is more a matter of the heart than of a geographical location. Some experience solitude even in the midst of the throng. Others cannot be solitary on a desert island. Still, physical isolation does help. And those who believe that they have grown so spiritual that physical solitude is not required ought to take note of Jesus' habit of seeking out the solitary place where the multitudes could not find him, at least not for a while. Even more important is the distinction between solitude and reclusiveness. As Thomas Merton said, some men have become monks in the hope that this would enable them to escape other men. But the only true justification for a life of deliberate solitude is the conviction that it will help you love not only God, but also other men. And as Henry Nguyen says of Merton, his withdrawal from the world brought him into closer contact with it. The more he was able to convert his restless loneliness into a solitude of heart, the more he would discover the pains of the world in his own inner center and respond to them. And of course, we must not confuse solitude with loneliness, even though the two can never be separated entirely, and I want to speak more about that next week. Our language has wisely sensed, wrote Paul Tillich, these two sides of man's being alone. It has created the word loneliness to express the pain of being alone, and it has created the word solitude to express the glory of being alone. And yet Tillich went on to say that loneliness can only be conquered by those who bear solitude. And therefore, as he suggests, solitude takes daring. In the poverty of solitude, he said, all riches are present. Therefore, let us dare solitude so as to be in touch with eternity, with ourselves and with others. It is this daring that we need today as we live in a society that so discourages solitude and often makes us feel guilty about it. Now, to be sure, Jesus was a man of the crowds and also a man of the small groups. But if we would be his disciples, we need to learn as well to live the paradox of getting in touch with the world and with God by deliberately being by ourselves. Let us then follow Jesus, both at the dawn and in the watches of the night.
Holy, 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 holy.
We hope you will join us again next Sunday for this weekly radio service of Pilgrim Congregational Church. Our worship at the church is held each Sunday morning at 10 o'clock. In place of a prayer today, let me read a short poem by Wendell Berry that should bring to mind a familiar experience to those who live in this part of the world. It is called The Quiet. The fishermen rose up the river at mid-morning, anchors outside the creek mouth. For hours he sits there in his boat, lines in the water, motionless and silent in the cool wind as a heron. The leaves have fallen. The rain has turned them pliant as water. Walking on them makes no noise. The country has taken on the quiet of the fisherman alone. And now, go into the world in peace, and may God go with you in the living of these days.
God of grace and God of glory, on thy people pour thy power. Crown thy ancient church's story, bring her but to glorious flower. Grant us wisdom, grant us courage, for the facing of
have been listening to The Living of These Days, the weekly radio service of the Pilgrim Congregational Church with Dr. Royal F. Shepherd, Jr., Minister. For copies of today's sermon or comments on this program, please contact the Pilgrim Congregational Church, 2310 East 4th Street in Duluth, 55812. And please join us next week at this same time for The Living of These Days.